When faced with an adversary, do you go in strong or weak?
I guess I would ask what context. Yeah, so.
In what context do you ever find yourself wrestling a grizzly bear, for instance, robbing a bank?
Like most writers, I'm probably more of an introvert. So you would like to think that you're a strong adversary, but I'm probably, based on my personality, more of a dodge and a juke and jive kind of guy, right?
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Alan Morris Jones about his noir mystery novel, Sweeney on the Rocks. We'll be talking mafia, murder, witness protection, and what makes Montana a perfect setting for all of it. Don't go away. How long was the idea for this book knocking around in your head? And where did the inspiration come from? Did you always want to write crime fiction?
So some years ago, and this was when I was living in Missoula, probably about the time that my first novel came out, so 2001, 2002, I read a book on the Witness Protection Program. It was a biography of the guy who founded the program. And it was a good general overview of that program and a good grounding in reality of a program that's really been fictionalized and used for all sorts of purposes in Hollywood and New York publishing. Montana kept popping up in that book. It popped up in several different places. And turns out in subsequent books and further reading that the idea of witness protection and specifically wise guys, you know, Italian mafia in Montana, in the Rocky Mountain West, isn't all that far-fetched. In some ways, it's a tired device, and I hesitated initially to go down that road with the book because it's been done so often, you know, witness protection. But the idea stuck with me. Then I began reading my way down the wise guy bookshelf, if you will, which is voluminous. I mean, if you're interested in that research, you can never come to the end of it. Everybody has a memoir. There's lots of academic studies. So as opposed to some of my other work, this one, the research preceded the writing. So I started reading, and then eventually this idea kind of bubbled up. And I wrote the first couple of scenes without knowing really where it was going. Is there potential here? Is this guy interesting enough to sustain a novel? And then all other sorts of interesting things came in. So Italian mafia, but then Russian mafia came to play a role. You know, the book kind of took me to some surprising places.
Right. I was tracking. Yeah. There's Italian bad guys, the Russian mafia, the witness protection program. And there are points that I was like, wait, what? Converging in Montana?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I want to know how you convinced yourself it could happen. And I also have an awareness that you lived in Brooklyn.
I did. I lived in Brooklyn for almost 3 years full time, but off and on, you know, over the course of 5 or 6 years. My wife and I were dating. We were both traveling back and forth. She lived in Brooklyn at the time. And then we were married and we had a child, and we were through our little boy's first year, we were in New York, at which point, once he became old enough to kind of start walking and knocking into things, it became clear that our small apartment in Brooklyn wasn't going to happen. So then we came back to Montana. But yeah, so Brooklyn was there during the writing of this novel. I had the opportunity to walk around different neighborhoods and get to know the area a little bit, which turns out was very important to this particular book.
I can't wait to get into some of the more nitty-gritty details about the plot and structure. But I also want to ask you, in whose tradition of crime writing are you following?
You would have to call this, you would call it noir, I'm sure. But it's also a little tongue-in-cheek, you know. It's not what I found as a writer is I couldn't, almost against my better instincts, I couldn't take myself too seriously writing the book. I mean, I'm a middle-aged white guy from Montana that's writing about Italian wise guys. You know, it's like, if I'm going to do this, I think it would be a mistake to take myself too seriously. So as the writer, I found a little bit of satire helped the work. It gave it a little bit of energy, you know.
I appreciate that word, satire, because the book feels like it's written from this really studied, postured place. Like, it's a tough book. And I just wanted to know, what's it like for like a white guy who hits up the rivers of Montana to write a Brooklyn mob stance?
I drew on my research. You know, I wanted it to feel real. Satire doesn't necessarily mean that it should be ill-informed. I think when you're writing satire, you almost have an obligation to go the other direction. You really have to have your ducks in a row so that the characters feel real and believable. In terms of the writing experience, it was really enjoyable. So I came off my previous book, A Bloom of Bones, was set in Montana, in northeastern Montana, a part of the world that I'm very familiar with. And in some ways, it was a more personal novel. That novel, I aspired to capital L literature, if you will. You know, I took it very seriously. I labored over it. I rewrote it multiple times. And I came out of that experience kind of exhausted. I wanted to try to make fiction fun again, you know? So this book, I wanted it to be opposite of how I felt at the end of A Bloom of Bones. So whatever it takes to find the joy in writing fiction again, that's what I wanted to do. And within genre, messing around with certain tropes, that gave me the freedom to focus on things that were really joyful. The smart turn of phrase, the calculated structure. You know, one of the things I wanted was to create a book that made you stay up late at night reading. So from a writer's perspective, that's a really interesting mechanical problem. How do you create a compelling fiction? All other questions aside, if your first concern is to create a really readable novel, something that people want to find out what happens at the end, what are the mechanical things you need to do in order to make that happen? The first thing you do is you create a compelling hook, which fits nicely with crime and mystery. You have a dead body at the beginning, and then you carry it on through. Who killed the guy? How did we get to this point? Within that armature, within the umbrella of the compelling question, once you know that you have the reader on your side, then you can do all sorts of interesting things with language, with character, with structure. So writing within genre in that case really freed me up.
Mm-hmm. Your main character, Cosimo, Cosmo, Agnello, came to be Ted Sweeney. Can you just tell a piece of that story?
As the novel opens, we see our hero, Ted Sweeney, not quite as it opens, a chapter or two into it. We see Ted Sweeney coming home from a hard day as a handyman. He has his own handyman business and looking forward to popping a beer and watching some baseball. And someone has deposited a body in his favorite easy chair. It's his old pal of a piece of furniture. I'm kind of proud of that particular turn of phrase. That then triggers the story. So here is Ted Sweeney, an affable everyman in Montana. And rather than doing what most of us would do in that situation, which is call the police and let the machine take over, for him, the most logical thing to do is to get rid of the body. So he dumps it in the Yellowstone River. From that point, then, we learn that he has a much more complicated history than anyone else in this fictionalized little Montana town.
And early on, you write from Ted Sweeney's thoughts, how much we take for granted, all these small miracles, buttons, chewing gum, zippers, unlocking his truck, turning the ignition, his cell phone, his microwave, jet contrails, in aggregate, our extraordinary days, and yet we die. So I was wanting to know, what is the existential inner life of Ted Sweeney?
Yeah, that's a really good question. He is in some ways, I suppose, more sophisticated in that regard than I am. As the writer, you have the opportunity to research your way into a sophisticated viewpoint. Kurt Vonnegut said something to the effect that it's one of the great things about the writing trades is that rewriting, you can make yourself look, you know, smarter and more sane than you actually are. So I wanted Ted Sweeney, who is Italian mafia, has a background in that, to nevertheless have read himself and educated himself into a position of social and cultural authority. So he's familiar with the great traditions in literature and philosophy and art. And through the course of the novel, he brings those in almost as incidental asides. So his frame of reference is such that he can look at his ex-wife and think of a portrait by Daumier, for instance. That comes to mind. I'm not sure if it works. I hope it works. But that was one of the other aspects that was very fun to write. Here's a character that gives me an excuse to bring that aspect of our culture into it. Do you see? Yeah.
I was tracking the names and authors that appear. I mean, there are references to Shakespeare and the Old Testament and even Harold and Maude, the film. Right. And I was curious, how much do you share with Sweeney, and in which ways are you very, very different characterologically?
In some ways, he's the furthest thing from me of any character that I've written. He has a background in pathological violence, and through the course of the novel, we recognize how he has tried to grow away from that. And in effect, he's trying, through the course of the novel, he recognizes his faults and he is trying to be a better person, but then he regresses. So as the novel proceeds, we see this guy whom we thought we knew as being kind of an admirable pillar of the community kind of guy, fall back on his original background, which is violent and self-serving, and he rationalizes violence.
Alan, there were moments in the book where the language is so strong and where you brush against taboo subjects like preteen sexual girls, you know, who have an encounter with Ted Sweeney. And I wanted to know what it was like to embody kind of this rude, unfiltered position, because I could imagine for someone like myself who spends most of her days being very polite, that it could be quite liberating to not have to wear that hat, but also I might feel sort of guilty. And I just wanted to, like, how did you reconcile some of the more rough parts of the book?
There were a couple of moments in the book where I really struggled with the idea, should I include this or not? I wrote them and then I took a step back and said, is this going to lose the reader? You know, I'm trying to create a complicated character, but you want him to be sympathetic as well. And so how far can you push that envelope? So at one point he stumbles across a scenario where a really reprehensible character is getting ready to film like child pornography. And then that gives our hero, Sweeney, the opportunity to really show his bad gangster side. It's in reaction against the villain who's doing this. But there's another scene where he loses track of himself and he commits an act of domestic violence. That one was really difficult for me. It's like, do I include this? Because this is a really bad thing for somebody to do. And then I thought, well, this is actually probably true to the character. He was a really awful person, but he is trying to grow past it, you know? So maybe it's not a bad thing to show this aspect of his personality.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Alan Morris Jones about his novel, Sweeney on the Rocks. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I feel like I'm bordering on cliche by saying, you know, like, art imitates life, but where do you, as a writer, like, ethically, where do we just mirror what naturally is violent and aggressive in our culture, and then how do we balance it? I mean, I hear you saying you balance it by trying to make a character who's pulling towards being a better person, but do you have any other advice for authors in this position of, do I write the thing that's kind of horrible, or like...
I hesitate to give kind of generalized advice. I think everyone has to find their own way. Having said that, there's almost no reason not to write something initially and then rewrite it and then take a step back and rewrite it again and then really reconsider what you've done. And then maybe at the end of the day, just because you wrote something doesn't mean that you have to publish it or let somebody see it. Especially in writing fiction, there is a strong argument to be made for writing a lot of backstory that doesn't end up seeing the light of day. You as the writer have an obligation to know as much as you can about your characters and their situations. And even if it doesn't make it into the final work, their work will be stronger for being informed by that exercise. So that happened with Sweeney as well. There are things that I wrote about this guy that didn't actually make the final cut. This is my third novel, and it seems like each one ends up being about half as long as the first draft. So my process of rewriting is really a process of cutting. As readers, we want to know what happens. We want to get to the end and find out the good stuff. A lot of the backstory is unnecessarily digressive.
Marilyn, Aggie, Tina, who are the women in Sweeney's life?
One of the things that was very important to me was to write strong three-dimensional female characters. So too often, maybe not even, not so much anymore, but historically, traditionally, too often male crime writers use women as foils. They are plot devices rather than being three-dimensional people themselves. So I wanted each of the female characters that I wrote about, you named the three principals, to be strong enough to carry their own story if the camera went that direction. So they have their own conflicts, they have their own backstories, they have their own hopes and dreams and fears and the whole mishmash that a character needs in order to feel believable. And in fact, if I continue this story, which I hope I will, one of the directions I may take it is to focus on Sweeney's ex-wife, who has a really interesting story that took me by surprise a little bit. She went from mob wife, you know, and all that means stereotypically with the furs and the jewels and the Brooklyn accent. And she landed as a deputy sheriff in my fictionalized Low Montana town. And that's a really interesting transition. How did she get there? And what sort of mental gymnastics did she have to go through in order to place herself in that position? I would like to explore that more in the future.
You've mentioned a fictional small Montana town twice now, and so I'm going there. You write, you know, it's a town of population of 6,000, and there are 21 churches in Rock Jaw and 23 bars. You also write, the thing about Rock Jaw, the mix of people. Any given afternoon, a switch operator for Burlington Northern will be drinking his suds beside a gimpy rancher who personally owns 50,000 acres of good graze along the Yellowstone. A medical marijuana caretaker will be hitting practice balls beside one of the early artists for Mad Magazine. First of all, is that your experience of Montana?
Yes, absolutely. And I grew up in Livingston, and that's my experience of Livingston specifically. And my town, I didn't want to write Livingston. I wanted to have more freedom than if I said Livingston, I would be obligated to reproduce the town. So I fictionalized my small Montana town, but it's a thinly disguised Livingston.
And for our listeners outside of the area, can you just get a snapshot of Livingston, Montana?
So Livingston, Montana is a wonderful but complicated small town, 50 miles north of Yellowstone. I moved there with my family in 82. I was 12 years old. At that time, it was blue-collar Burlington Northern Railroad town. during my time there, between when we moved there and by the time I graduated from high school in 89, it had transitioned. The railroad closed up their shops. Most of the friends that I went to high school with, a good portion of them moved away, their parents following jobs. And in that same time, the Church Universal and Triumphant moved into Park County. And so the population more or less stayed steady. It's just that the demographic changed, which was, in retrospect, was fascinating. So a small town whose character changes, you know, almost overnight. And then since then, it's made another transition into this kind of vibrant arts community, which is also interesting. I live in Bozeman now, so I don't know Livingston quite as well as I used to, but I love going over there.
So it's true that when I read this, it reminded me of another book that I read, Jamie Harrison's The Widow Nash, where a young woman reinvents herself in a very sort of similar feeling way, but in a very different time period. And it made me so curious about the magnetic pull of Livingston to be willing to host these stories of reinvention. What is it about Livingston that makes it the perfect setting for people to come and start over? I mean, partly what you just said, it's changed faces so many times.
It's a good question. I hadn't thought of it in particularly those terms. One of the interesting things about Livingston and Montana in general, I think, is the way there is very little separation between the social classes. So you go to San Diego, you go to Seattle, you go to Long Island, the very wealthy are behind walls. There's very little commingling between the classes. In Livingston, that's not the case. As in that portion you read, you go to the Murray Bar and have a beer, and you could very well be sitting next to a multimillionaire on one side and an average Joe on the other side. So having that available to us, I'm just guessing here, I don't know, but maybe that adds another layer of potential to the fiction. So there are more characters commingling and able to interact with each other, which makes it a richer venue for telling a story.
I'll buy it. Yeah. All right, I'm thinking about having you read.
Catering to the Disaffected Rich, turns out, is one of Montana's principal industries. Wheat, cattle, tourism, sure, you bet. But dig the coin generated by second homes, the thousands of log mansions tucked away in darling little stands of aspens, Remington ripoffs and trout ponds out back, Bierstadt through each window and a nice wraparound porch. God bless the faceless out-of-staters. How they support an entire subculture of antler chandelier artisans and fireplace masons, snowplowers and gardeners. Not to mention a good portion of these homes, empty 9-10 months out of the year. The owners aren't as wealthy as they'd like you to think. They sublet, thus making their private paradises available for a rate. They rely on property management firms to take care of the details. Take this place on Jack Creek, for instance. Rented sight unseen with a Visa card in the name of an infant dead these last 12 years. FedEx the keys. See you next week. 10 miles south of Rockjaw, it's 40 acres backed up against National Forest. End of the road with a view. 3 stories. Front yard is asphalt driveway. Backyard is all flagstones and hot tub. By rumor, the owners are third-generation Pfizers, or maybe Waltons, or Krogers. Marble countertop and flagstone floors in the kitchen. An 8-burner stove with an exhaust hood that'll suck the gravel right off your palm. Down the short hallway, past framed photos of soft white men on yachts, victims of too much, too early, beached now in middle age, simmering in the juices of myopic self-interest. A half dozen bedrooms. And down a spiral staircase, constructed from kiln-dried teak shipped up from Costa Rica, a wet bar and liquor cabinet, snooker table, and is that a bocce ball court? Anyway, the middle of the room, 2 log pillars, old-growth white pine, thick as Ionic columns.
When I read that, it seemed like such a very real place, a place that maybe even I have driven past. And I just wanted to know both any commentary from you on the tension you see and feel around the out-of-staters or the second homes, or I don't know what you want to call it, and also what's your vision for Montana moving forward, you know, this place that we call the West?
Commentary on wealth disparity in the West. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I think there are people who are moving here who become valuable members of the community. And I think that's the crux of it, that no matter your circumstances, when you come to Montana or any other community, that you make an effort to contribute and be a part of the larger whole. So often it seems like that is not the case, that you will move here or somewhere like Montana, and it will be a drop-in a couple weeks a year vacation home, in which case you are not contributing significantly to the community that helps create this environment. I think that's the danger. Tying in a bit to what I was talking about earlier, how Livingston commingles the classes, I think that's one of the virtues of Montana, is that even the very wealthy have an opportunity to contribute to the community of which they aspire to be a part. If they don't, then something is wrong. And what was the second part of your question?
What's your vision? What's your vision for the West?
The Rocky Mountain West, in the context of, not really sure how far we want to go down this road, but in the context of rising population and limited resources, I think we need to be very, very careful moving forward, particularly with issues like water allocation, and with every new subdivision, and when construction is so often the economic driver, it's a temptation to see the growth as a good thing without an asterisk next to it. But we have to be very careful in that regard. So cautiously optimistic. I love Montana. I love the place where I live. I think it's fantastic, and it's made fantastic by the people who live here. We just need to be very careful not to become like every other place.
Alan Morris Jones lives in Bozeman, Montana. As a jack of all trades, he's the author of 3 acclaimed novels, as well as a children's book and over 100 published poems, essays, and articles. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Bethann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.